Thank you very much, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Oram. I represent Mr. Cobb in this particular case. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so I'll only argue for 10 minutes at this point. Mr. Cobb should receive a new trial for a number of different reasons. First and foremost, the way jury selection was handled in this particular case. Defense counsel, Mr. Brett Whipple, asked that a new jury veneer be brought into the court. There were, from the record that I can tell, there were 70 prospective jurors brought in. Of those 70, there were two African-American males that is placed on the record. As I do the calculations, because this court was considering this matter in Williams versus State, and this court found that, according to the census, approximately 9.1% of our population here in Clark County are African-Americans, and this court further found that approximately 7.5 to 10% are usually present of African-Americans in a 40-person veneer.
Well, we've done some calculations, too. You use 70 persons. Our review indicates that the entire veneer was approximately 120, of which 7 were African-Americans, or 5.8%. Why would we use 70 rather than 120?
Because I believe that's what they were picked from. And
for purposes of determining the veneer, it's who's been called out from the community to participate, isn't it?
No, I wouldn't think so. In other words, Justice Hardesty, if we go down right now into the lower level and find where the jurors are right now, and we have 150 jurors that could be potentially on a jury, if they only bring up 40 of those, should we really be calculating the other ones? Because what Mr. Cobb had is he had an opportunity to pick a jury from 70. Those are the 70 that were used to pick his jury. And so maybe there was an additional number somewhere else or potentially available, but they weren't available to him in his jury trial. Do you see my point? That if it wasn't available to him, it's just not available to him. And if you look at the actual jury voir dire that takes place in this particular case, there are 70 to pick from, and there were only two African Americans on that jury potential that were potentially available, and both of them were excluded by the state of Nevada, which
wanted to have you articulate why you feel that the measuring stick, so to speak, should be 70 rather than 120 that were called to service in this case.
And actually, what I thought was interesting is
you don't disagree that there was 120 called to service for the case.
I don't disagree with that. However, what I think is interesting is the state doesn't even make that argument from what I could tell. Because in my reply brief, I comment on the fact that the state tries to claim that there were only 60. So they try, according to their calculations, they come up with 5.8%. Because they try to say there was a third one, but if you go back and look at the record, it really appears to be an Asian man out of 60. And so when you really break it down to what was available, there were 70, and there were two African-American women on the prospective jury panel, and both were excluded. And so what I see is that's 2.8%, according to my calculations, 2.8%. And that is well below the standard enunciated by this court in Williams versus State. What is also of concern is that when Mr. Whipple had Miss Judy Rowland, the jury commissioner, testify, she discussed how the Bill 43 was coming into effect that would mean that we are going to obtain our jurors from a list from Nevada Power as opposed to the DMV. I know this is maybe outside the record, but I believe that has come into effect, and I think that the court would see that there are going to be a lot more minorities present in jury panels now. But nevertheless, what happens is Mr. Cobb, an African-American male, is then left with an all-white jury. And what I thought was even more interesting is when you break down the race-neutral reasons for the exclusion of the two potential African-American jurors, one was that that they knew a family member who had been involved or had been incarcerated, and that would be Mrs. Dawson, number 639.
Well, before you get to the two jurors specifically, I wonder if you could address the third element, which requires a demonstration of systematic exclusion, I guess, best way to put it. In this case, it looks like the only evidence, I should say the evidence, to support systematic exclusion was the examination of the juror commissioner and her description of the Department of Motor Vehicles as the source. How does that satisfy systematic exclusion under Williams?
I think it proves it. And here's why I think it proves it. It proves it because why are we changing? I mean, during trials, I know this, the justices on this court have conducted many, many trials. And why are we changing it? If the DMV was fine, what was the purpose in changing it? What the purpose of changing it is exactly what Ms. Rowland said, is that we're going to apply these new standards. And what I think we're seeing is that Nevada Power, when they're going out and we're using Nevada Power, a lot of people register for, you know, they're in an apartment or something along those lines that apparently they don't do when they're at the DMV. So the very fact that the state of Nevada is going to change their procedure shows that there was some exclusion.
Mr. Orem, should we just point blank then, if there's something that possibly may improve the system, look at it as suspect and strike things based upon that reasoning?
I think we should, when we have a jury panel like this one, where you have 2.8% of your population, where it should be 9.1, or as this court said in Williams.
Well, I've heard that and I got that, but the question is, realistically, do we have statistics or do we have any information from Department of Motor Vehicles that because of the makeup of, as you said, the population and the makeup of the DMV list, that it is a systematic exclusion?
I don't have anything in the record to say that. I have to go outside the record and make an argument, because when defense counsel questioned Ms. Judy Rowland, I can only go on what she said. But what I'm reading from that is that there was a necessity to make this change. And now I know I have to go outside the record to say what I'm seeing in the six murder trials I've done in the last 12 to 13 months. There's a difference.
We don't have any information yet as to this change, but the hope for is that the numbers would be higher. And all I can say right now is the hope for. And that's the problem we're getting into right now. But we still get into this systematic. And is it?
Well, I think it's systematic because we're using the DMV. And now we're not using the DMV. And we're going to get a large number of minorities coming in. And I would argue that the state of Nevada was correct in their assessment that we should use Nevada Power. And I think that does remedy the previous problem that Mr. Cobb endured. And
I may have misunderstood the jury commissioner's testimony, and help me there. Was the testimony that by utilizing customers of Nevada Power would accomplish an expansion of the jury pool, or was the purpose to increase the amount of minorities in the jury pool? I understood the testimony to be we're increasing the number of potential jurors, that its purpose wasn't targeted to resolve a perceived lack of minorities in the jury pool. Could you please clarify her testimony?
Your Honor, it would be difficult for me to try to interpret what she was saying.
We can agree on what she said.
Yes.
Am I correct that the record shows her testimony to be that the purpose was to expand the jury pool?
Yes.
As contrasted with, we're doing this, or we believe this is a better way to increase minority participation in the jury pool.
The testimony she gave, I believe, is consistent with what you said at first. It was to expand the jury.
So your argument is that we should take that testimony to mean not only an expansion of the jury pool, but also to address the lack of minorities within the jury.
And I would argue that that's correct.
Do I have your argument correct?
Yes. Okay. And I think that's exactly what it's done. Because I didn't ever see or perceive a problem with jurors not having enough jurors. I just never saw that as a problem.
Given the amount of time you have, could you address why you think Juror Dawson creates a Batson problem?
Juror Dawson creates a Batson problem because she had a family member in California who had, she thought, been treated unfairly. They were treated unfairly, but she says she knew nothing about the crime. And so my real concern there is that if you take three African-Americans over here, okay, prospective jurors, and I can say, without questioning any of them, you know what, we need to get rid of all three of them. Why? Because I'm concerned. I'm concerned about the fact that these people have had somebody closely associated with them or somebody, a family member, a friend, arrested, and I'm concerned about what that means to the state of Nevada. Now, statistics show that about, I believe, 50% of African-American males in a lifetime may be arrested. Therefore, I've got a 50-50 chance that each one of their fathers may have been arrested. Nevertheless, grandfather, uncles, brothers, best friends, husbands, children. And so anytime you say that about African-American males or females, you have a 50-50 chance just with their father. And so statistically, I think anytime you're just saying, look, that African-American male or female, they can't be fair to the state of Nevada because they've had somebody who was incarcerated, it's such a circular argument, it will work in every peremptory challenge. And so what concerned me here is this woman said she could be fair. I highlighted it extensively in my brief. She said she could be fair. So just the fact that you've had somebody in California that was arrested or incarcerated, that's sufficient and that's a race-neutral reason to get rid of a prospective juror, they can use it in every single case and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And here they used it in both with Mrs. Gardner and Mrs. Dawson, 639 and 884. And as I look at that, they made it so it was a jury without any African-American males. I just reserved my last 3 minutes and 15 seconds.
Okay, Mr. Orm, thank you. Okay, Mr. Stanton.
Good morning, David Stanton on behalf of the state. I think your questions to Mr. Orem hit the nail on the head regarding the composition of the veneer as it exhibited back when this trial occurred as a matter of policy. And that is, what is missing from the record and missing from the argument from Mr. Orem this morning is any evidence, which would relatively be easy to establish, that any method of the veneer selection was in and of itself evidence of a systematic exclusion of ethnicity or minorities. That is, the voter records, power records, DMV records, whatever list you draw from, that there would be some evidence and testimony either in the change in the legislature or at the time of this trial through the jury commissioner that would show that that list systematically excluded minorities. And that would be relatively easy to obtain. And the reason why it wasn't presented is because it doesn't exist. Fatal defect in that argument is that none of those lists were created or designed or by their implementation systematically excluding minorities. The list and the change was precisely as indicated here this morning to broaden the base of the individuals that are selected for jury service. As far as the particular...
Mr. Stanton, could you address Mr. Orem's argument about the size of the veneer? There is a concern, I think, that one calls 120 to service, 60 or 70 get into the courtroom. Does that subsequent reduction, so to speak, in the number of jurors called to service affect how the court should view the veneer and its call to service?
Respectfully, I think that the assessment should be the number of jurors that particular trial judge calls for jury duty on that particular case. Where those jurors are picked numerically is just purely random. There's no exclusion, certainly no evidence of exclusion, that minorities were put at the end of the list and thus excluded from being the first 60 or 70, whatever number accurately reflects what was pulled up to be the initial panel. The logistics of this courthouse, as counsel Mr. Orem is well familiar with, is that you can't have 120 jurors sitting in any of the district courts down below to effectively conduct voir dire.
So the process
the process is what limits it just from a logistical perspective. And once again, you would have to have some evidence, and I submit none exist, either through the jury commissioner, that somehow they're giving instructions to the staff down below that minorities are at the end of the list, and that 60 or 70 that come up, as would be the type of case that could prove that, indeed would exclude minorities in that situation. The key, as I believe...
So the group that ends up in the courtroom is randomly selected.
Correct, and they're given a numerical assessment by the jury commissioner's office so that when they come up, they sit in the courtroom in the fashion so that we as the attorney in the court and the clerks, court staff, when the jurors are called, we know which jurors are brought up into the box because they sit in the court in the numerical order that they're assigned by the jury commission.
What was the number of Dawson and Carter again?
Dawson was 639, Ms. Gardner was 884. Mm-hmm. And as the trial counsel, Mr. Orms, reading from a record, no fault of his own, but both me and Mr. DiGiacomo, the trial counsel for the state, indicated in the record both the basis to exclude Ms. Dawson, juror 639, and Ms. Gardner, Mrs. Gardner, at 884. I believe we cited in our responding brief the actual transcript of the question and answer between those jurors, and I would submit that at least as Mrs. Dawson relates, and really the only one that the record down below is preserved regarding a Batson challenge, indicates, I think, two important things. Number one is Ms. Dawson answered not just in the general question, as Mr. Orm phrased it, that someone in their family or close relative had been charged, but she specifically expressed an opinion that the person was treated in her mind unfairly and, to use her words, too harshly. So Mr. Orm phrases it as a general category that someone within their family slash close friends was brought into the system via an arrest. But it's much more than that.
Did the judge abuse the discretion in determining that she hadn't been Dawson hadn't been adequately rehabilitated by saying, "I can't bear"?
I don't believe so, nor any argument made this morning that indeed the trial judge who saw the question and answering process in the voir dire selection made a specific finding that indeed a race neutral reason was proffered, and that was accepted by the trial court. And I highlight that both juror 841 and 897 were excluded by the state for the exact same reasons as given by Ms. Dawson. So the record directly reflects a race neutral reason and consistency by the state in offering that peremptory exercise of the peremptory challenge as to Mrs. Dawson. And one of the most compelling things, me as a trial lawyer, the one who questioned Ms. Dawson, both in a capital context and in this case with Mr. Cobb, a non-capital murder case, one question that I always ask every juror is, if you're selected as a foreperson, can you sign your verdict, your name to the verdict form that either puts this defendant to death or sentence the defendant to life without the possibility of parole? Obviously, I'm interested in the answer to the question, but also the physical reaction to my question and how they interact with me.
Counsel, do you have some type of, I ask you this question, scientific basis for that? Because we're talking about, we're moving out of the arena of cocktail or coffee conversation. It's no different than a judge having to sign a warrant of death. It becomes real when you have to put your name on it. I would hope that on something like that, someone might feel uncomfortable having to make that kind of decision ultimately. If you feel very comfortable signing your name to death, then I might question who you are and what you're about in a personal experience as a sitting trial judge.
Absolutely, Judge.
Sitting there and signing a warrant of death, whether I think the person ultimately deserves it or not, is still something that I'm just not comfortable with, but you do it because it's part of the job.
Absolutely.
So the question, returning to, you're saying you ask every juror this question. Based upon what? What did you read, or is this something you learned at a school or something that you should ask?
I learned it, Judge, from doing approximately 20 years of trial, about 15 years doing murder cases. And my experience tells me that just like in a polygraph examination, people are naturally nervous because of the environment, but it's the attendant reaction to me and the interaction with the defendant as to whether or not their statement of what they ultimately give is the answer to that question, whether or not I believe it. In that short period of time that we're permitted to inquire as to these questions. And time again, as I'm sure you can recall when you were a trial judge, that you would have jurors that would say, you know, exactly as you stated. One thing is a theoretical aspect, talking about it at a cocktail party, but now that you ask me that question and I'm sitting in this courtroom knowing that I might have to do that, that's a different question.
Isn't there two different questions? Would you feel comfortable doing this, or will you do it if you're so charged?
Well, I think that it's...
That's my question for you. Do you think? Because if I ask you, will you obey that and sign that, and your answer is yes, opposed to I don't feel comfortable, but yes, I will do my duty. Because quite often asking jurors questions, they will tell you honestly, I will do my duty.
And that's just as important to me, that they are being honest with me, saying, look, I have trouble thinking about making that decision, but I will abide by my oath. That absolutely is part of the analysis and the assessment that I'm making at the time of that question.
Unless Justice Hardesty wants to continue in this area, I have a question just in reference to the hearsay.
Yes.
As to Contreras and Hernandez, and as to the hand gesture, whether that was error and whether that should tarnish the conviction as we presently have.
If I may, Judge, to answer your question, first of all, there were two communications that were admitted at trial. One, obviously, was the communication that you didn't ask in your question, but I think sets up and at least is in context to the second part, and that is the victim in that case, some brief months before his murder, she had observed her boyfriend engage with Mr. Cobb and ask him about what occurred. Critically important was two things. One is the reference that the person that did it was shady, and number two, that he was asking him about his gang affiliation, which obviously becomes extremely relevant for the purposes of what, why, and the circumstances of when this murder took place. The second aspect of that was under the context in the hospital of when the victim was still alive, but his father was extremely concerned about who was coming to visit his son at the hospital, as the evidence was adduced at trial. And I think in critical importance to the assessment of the hearsay statement and its reliability was this was done in the context of his father filtering who was coming to see his son, fearful that someone might attempt to take his life again. And it was in that context where the second statement pursuant to his girlfriend, where he identifies the term shady. Once again, non-testimonial.
But how does that relate to the answer you just gave me? Because the question was as to, in essence, who shot you, if I'm putting it in proper context.
I'm not sure I understand your question as far as the context of when he identified the second time that it was shady.
When and what the purpose was for that identification.
I think the purpose was is to inform his family that the person of who the person was that shot him, and that that person was not present or caused a concern to his father in the hospital.
Don't we have a Crawford problem with that?
No, I don't believe so, because under the criteria as articulated in Harkins, that this is not testimonial in nature. It was not made to law enforcement. It was made under circumstances that were unrelated to that and certainly not could not have perceived have been in anticipation of litigation in the future. It was simply a matter in an intra-family scenario at a hospital to preserve and protect his son and the inquiry of who this had done. Understanding, Judge, that when this occurred after this identification was made or statement made of Shady, she contacted the police. The police brought out a photographic lineup, showed it to the victim, who identified clearly with his finger tapping on the third position of the photographic lineup, the Delbert Cobb. That identification was suppressed, even in light of the fact that the defense proffered numerous witnesses to say that there was more than one Shady, moniker of the person in the Las Vegas Valley that was a member of a criminal gang, and that there was more than one Shady in the 28th Street gang of which Mr. Cobb was a member. And yet the state was not entitled then to bring that identification in after the defense proffered and hid behind that shield, then indeed there could have been more than one Shady that was identified by the victim, knowing full well that the evidence was directly and opposite of that. So number one, no, I don't think it violates Crawford. And number two, the ruling by the court was ultra conservative, and I believe indeed they had opened the door wide open to then permit the absolute identification of the defendant by the victim. By the inference that there was more than one Shady in this valley, they directly put at issue whether or not the defendant had misidentified some other Shady to his father, to his family, and to his girlfriend in the hospital, of which it was clear evidence, although suppressed, that indeed the victim had positively identified the defendant by hand gestures when he was unable to speak at the hospital.
But you don't see a problem with Crawford, and you don't see a problem with reliability because death was not imminent in this particular case.
I don't think the death being imminent is what speaks to the reliability of it. I think.
Well, I was looking for something to hang a hat on in terms of reliability.
I think the five criteria set forth in Harkins is satisfied by the factual underpinning of when the statement was given. In fact, all five criteria, I believe, are satisfied to show the reliability and the credibility of that statement at the time that it was given. Every case that has adopted Crawford as a testimonial aspect has indicated that there's been some involvement with the police and thus the motive, potentially, of someone giving that in that context.
But it doesn't obviate the Still requirement that it be an exception to a hearsay statement.
Correct, and I believe in this particular case, under at least as the first one, it was under 51085, and this one is 51.315, among others. But certainly that one, if there isn't some context of reliability, when your father is seeking to protect his son at a hospital, about who's around him, and the motive for the son to then express who his killer was, or at that time the attempted killer, and someone known to that victim, because they went to school together, I think is another aspect of the reliability nature.
All right, are there any other questions by the panel members? Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Mr. Oram, you have 3 minutes plus.
Thank you.
Mr. Oram, I have a question. You raised a point in your oral argument that African Americans are more likely to have family members who have a criminal background statistically, and that therefore that impugns the legitimacy of it being a race-neutral reason when the state says this person had a family member who has had criminal conviction or criminal prosecution. Was that point raised in the trial court when the challenge to the race-neutral reason was articulated by the state?
I don't believe that what I'm saying right here to this court was raised at that time. There was a Batson objection, but the statistics that I've cited and what I'm saying I don't believe was said at that time. However, what I would point out is what's interesting is I think if an African-American says, you know what, my family member, my dad, was mistreated by that office, and I don't like those people, I think that, or even, you know, looks at the prosecutor and says, you know, my family member was treated unfairly by your office, I think that starts to give rise to a race-neutral reason. But look at what Juror Dawson said, and I'm citing to page 6 of my reply brief, and I cite to volume 5, page 900 through 902. The prosecutor says, is there anything out of that experience that sticks out in your mind that makes you someone that would be carrying over what you know, your feelings about the case, into this case if you sat as a juror? No, because I don't know anything about it. That's what she responded. I don't know anything about it. So how is it, we're really worried about that juror, because that juror can't be fair. The juror is answering that, yes, I have some relative of mine in California that had a problem, and, you know, I don't know much about it, and I can be fair. And that's the race-neutral reason? Well, that's going to apply, and that's what I meant. Have four prospective jurors over there that are African American, and that's what's going to happen each and every time. You can do it every single time. I mean, it's going to be rare that you wouldn't. I obviously have never done the experiment, but could we really go down and bring 10 African American prospective jurors in here and say, who doesn't have a friend or family member who's been arrested? Who doesn't? And I mean, it would almost, it would surprise me if somebody said, I've never known anybody who was arrested. I'm sure it happens, I'm sure.
Where are you getting your statistic from?
I think when I cited, what I cited, I believe, and I can't tell you where in the opening brief, was just that the amount of African-American males arrested. And if you just use the logic, if it's almost 50% arrested in their lifetime.
But where are you getting that 50%?
I believe it's from census, or I believe it's, I can't tell you. I can't, as I'm standing here, accurately tell you the statistic. Okay. But I think it's well known. I think it's common knowledge that the statistic is about that high. I think you can just Google that and see that. But nevertheless, I don't see how you bring
in... I have less faith in Google maybe than you. But.
Yeah. Well, I think the statistic is open and notorious. I don't think what I'm saying is shocking to anybody. It really is a very high percentage. I remember learning it in law school. It's a very high percentage. Additionally, I wanted to make something clear that was... Can I just finish very quickly? The jury pool, now I'm referring to the state's brief, they even say the jury panel was selected from the first group of 60 potential jurors. Even if you look at the 120, not one African-American on this jury. And so with that, I would ask that Mr. Cobb's convictions be reversed.
All right. Mr. Oram, Mr. Stanton, always a pleasure to have you argue, and we appreciate your briefs and arguments.
Thank you,
gentlemen. We'll be in recess till 11:30.
All rise.